Force field is at 25% strength.
Booster ignition is go.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Delphi Podcast. I'm Tom Shaughnessy, and I help lead Delphi Ventures, as well as host some of the most in-the-weeds and thought-provoking guests across crypto, spanning Layer 1s to DeFi, NFTs, and beyond. The goal is to have fun, but also to dive deep and offer foundational episodes on projects and founders. Also, check out our research on Delphi Digital, or miss out on the most compelling research there is. It's up to you. As a reminder, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token, or to make any financial decisions. Delphi Ventures may hold tokens mentioned, so check out our transparency page in the show notes for more info. With that, let's dive in. See you guys on the other side.
Auto sequence start in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Before we jump in, we want to thank Kava for making this episode possible. Kava is a cross-chain DeFi platform that gives you the ability to earn more by connecting the world's largest cryptocurrencies, ecosystems, and financial applications in one safe and seamless integration. Protocols built on the Kava platform include the Kava protocol, which enables you to take out loans by locking collateral to mint and borrow stablecoins, the HARD protocol, the world's first cross-chain money market, and coming soon, the Swap protocol, a cross-chain AMM liquidity hub bridging DeFi, blockchains, and financial services to swap the world's largest assets and maximize yields across your entire portfolio. Learn more or try for yourself today at kava.io.
All right, everyone. Today, I'm very happy to be here with Perpetual Protocol. We'll be interviewing Yenwen and Nick alongside my colleague, Jonathan Ehrlich. So we've been working with this team for a long time in various capacities. They've achieved insane traction for their V1 version of their protocol, which we'll get into later. And this week they announced V2, which is a pretty big departure from V1 and also like a very interesting design trade-off. So in this podcast, we're going to be digging into all of that. Yenwen and Nick, very happy to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Cool. But before getting into all things Perp, I'd love to learn more about your background and how you got into crypto.
Sure. So let me start first. So I'm the co-founder of Perpetual Protocol. My co-founder and I, we actually fell down the crypto rabbit hole in 2018. And we working on an option protocol at that time. So kind of like a little bit ahead of its time. And if I look at like, me, myself, like 3 years ago, I really don't know like what I was doing at that time. So, and the market crash, so we don't really, get any like funding. So actually the project failed. But, we do want to scale in this like crypto, ecosystem. So we actually go to Binance Lab to join their incubation. So, so we actually working on a crypto accounting software at that time. And, it's actually working okay. So we work on this for a year. But in 2019, we see the traction of Uniswap and Synthetix. We found that actually AAM is quite interesting. That it's kind of like at the center of the whole DeFi. If we can build an AAM for other financial instruments, I think that would be more interesting. So that's actually why we drop the crypto accounting software and then we go back to pick up the derivative. And in 2020, we think that perpetual swap is probably the most easiest one if we want to build AAM on top of it. So that's why we just go ahead and build AAM for the perpetual swap. Yeah. So fast forward to now, the change launched last December, and then it's been running for like 6 months already, and the traction is quite good. We have like around like 20 billion trading volume. Totally. I think that's really good for a new like protocol. So yeah, everything turns out to be like working well. Yeah, that's from my end.
Cool. And just a quick background. I've been kind of in and out of crypto. Started in kind of 2013, part of the Mt. Gox hacks. So I kind of left for a bit. Came back in kind of 2016. And kind of ran a friends and family kind of arbitrage fund, joined a fintech after that, and then more recently joined back again pre-DeFi summer, kind of exploring the space, and then kind of joined Perpetual Protocol as head of strategy after that. So that's a, yeah, that's my journey so far.
That's awesome. Yeah, I really appreciate those intros. And I think perps are a complicated product, and I think the implementations of decentralized perps are quite complicated. So we want to start at a high level and kind of narrow down and go through V1 and then like the reason for V2. So to begin with, could you define what a perpetual future contract actually is?
Yeah, hopefully I can, I can explain it well. So perpetual contract, I think, is actually being like a populated, I mean, by BMAX in 2016. So so at the time they have, I mean, like it's actually the beginning of crypto, and it's not the beginning, but at the time Bitcoin is big, but also like you have like other altcoin, but I think that at the time it's really hard to, it's not like right now, I mean, you know, most of the token are ERC20 token, you know, they are different chains. So it's really hard to have like change that trade all the financial instruments. So they come up with this idea that they can have a future. It kind of like it expires every day. So it actually expires very quick, but in the long run, it actually kind of like you can chase another index. So which means that they can create this exchange, and then people can, I mean, trade like you know, other asset that they don't have. So you don't really need to have the underlying. So this like expiring everyday futures can trace that index of everything. So I think that's how they, I mean, that's the reason that they want to invent this. And also at the same time, it's a future, so you can kind of leverage. So the, I mean, the cost of trading this instrument is pretty cheap, and you can get leverage. So that's why it gets so popular, I mean, within the central exchange.
Okay, very interesting. And could you give like just an idea of the, because obviously these products didn't really exist before crypto, if that's correct. And but they're like the pretty much the highest traction product within crypto, right? Like, why do you think, I guess, it's been so successful?
That's a good question. I think that it's actually very easy to use. I mean, like if you know the funding rate, I mean how it works. I think it's that for most of traders, I mean they can understand. And it's, I mean, like I said, the transaction cost is really low. So I think that people who, I mean, traders who want to take leverage, I think this is actually the preferred way in crypto world, that you know, you can just you know, go to a central exchange and then take, I mean, most of the exchange, they offer like 100x leverage. So you can take whatever leverage you want. So I think it's just like easy to access. And then the concept is not that hard to get. So so it's really popular, I mean, among the traders. But still, I mean, it's not a financial instrument for retails, although there are lots of retail trading this. But, you know, high leverage means that you might get hurt. I mean, I lost your asset. I mean, but that's probably not like so good to retails. But anyway, I mean, that's what I think. Yeah.
Okay, cool. And now I guess going into perp V1 and how you managed to allow people to trade perps in a decentralized way, can you explain a bit of the VAMM architecture, how that works, and maybe even like how you arrived at it and what other options you considered and like some of the problems you had to solve? That'd be really cool.
Sure. Yeah, so it will be a long answer. Okay, so perp V1, so we have this idea last year. So so it's actually based on a new design of ANM. So we call this virtual ANM. By virtual, we mean that we actually mean a lot of virtual tokens in this model. So how it works is that we actually have like kind of like two components. So the first component is kind of like a clearinghouse of a system that we can mint virtual token. So like trader, they can put in USDC as collateral, and then based on the collateral they mint or and also the leverage they want. Like for example, you put in like 100 USDC, we actually can mint, I mean, if you want to take a 2x leverage, we can mint like 200 virtual USDC, or we can mint like 200 worth of virtual ETH. So it depends on like, I mean, you know, long short, or like depends on the market you want to participate. So that's the first part. So we have these virtual tokens. And then the second part is actually a pricing engine. So we can put this virtual token into, like, so in Perp V1, we have this SYK pricing engine. So if I want to take a long position, I should put in virtual USDC, and then I get some virtual ETH out. And then that virtual ETH is actually the long position I own. And after a while, I can do it like reversely. I can put VEs back and then get all USDC, and then that will the difference will be my P&L. So that's actually how it works. I mean in general. So yeah.
Hey Edwin, can you get into sort of for example how a market is set up in Perpetual V1, like how the process looks like from your side? Because I think that sort of sets the stage for V2 and sort of for the concepts that went into creating V2.
Pami, you said that how the maker work, or
like what's the process, I guess, to start a market in Process V1? Oh. Like how in Perp V1, how are the markets actually initialized?
Yep. So in Perp V1, all the market, I mean, like it has to go through the voting process. So we have this like governance voting. So all the token holders, someone has to create a vote first, and then people can vote on that. And then once it passed, the team actually get to work and then try to like create that market for the token holders. So that's how it works now. So we actually have a lot of like voting on like which market that people want. And so after it got passed, we just launched that market. So it's kind of like a manual, process, like from our end. So that's definitely something we want to make it better.
Nice. And there are also some parameters, some important parameters that need to be sort of defined before creating a market, right?
Yes.
Specifically, sort of the gate parameter, that sort of defines the depth of each market. Can you go into sort of that process and sort of what that entails for V1?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's a hard one as well. So so the key, so like I said, so we have like these two components, and then one of the pricing component, that one, we are using the SYK model, which is like Uniswap V2. The interesting thing of this is that Uniswap, how they decide K is that by the liquidity provider. So the more liquidity they provide, the higher the K. So it depends on the liquidity. But because all our tokens are actually virtual tokens. So we actually can mint those virtual tokens. So it actually kind of like interesting that how about we actually mint the token pre-market. So before we launch that market, we actually mint a bunch of tokens and then put in there. Then those tokens will become the liquidity of this market, right? So that's actually the thing that John mentioned, that we can actually mint a lot of virtual token before we enable this market. So we actually have a process that we actually detail in the community that we calculate the slippage. I mean, kind of like for this market, I mean, how much slippage we want to have. For example, like putting like 100,000 USDC. If I want to open a long position with 100,000 USDC, I mean, how much slippage I will have. And then based on this, we will decide that K parameter. And then we will create market for that. So that's the process. I mean, it's like John said, it's actually very manual. That, we don't really have it's a process right now. We use the slippage, but there might be a better way. But we just, we don't really have a lot of things that can back up like using other method. But anyway, that's what we have right now, and then that's also something we want to fix.
I just want to double tap on that because I think it's a really important point to understand V2. You explained it really well, like the perpetual system where there's these two parts, right? You have the clearinghouse, which is kind of an accounting system that's used for settlement. And then you have the VAMM, which is mainly used to price, right? To mm-hmm. price this liquidity. And it's virtual in the sense that there is no liquidity in there and there are no liquidity providers, right? Which yes. is why this K parameter has to be set sort of manually. And could you maybe just talk a bit for people for whom it's not intuitive, like what's the impact of that K parameter and like what factors do you take into account when you set it?
Sure. So so for K, basically we want to have, the K as large as possible. I mean, if we can take, we want to be like a number that approach infinity. Why is that? It's because the larger the K, the less the slippage, the better to the traders. So because we want to have provide like very low slippage to the traders, that means that the platform is very efficient. So definitely the larger the better. But there is a limit. I mean, like it cannot be like if have like a number, close to infinite, because if we have like such a large number, which also means that because this is an ANM, so every time you want to move the price, you have to create a trade. So if we have a really large K, which means that we need to provide a lot of order of trades to move the price, so which actually make it really hard for price to move. If the price doesn't move, the market actually crash. So we need to find that balance. So the larger the K, the lower the slippage, but at the same time, we need to find a reasonable K that's actually, the trading burden that we have right now is enough to move the price just like hashing like normally, just like other market. So that's a trade-off. So one way we use is just like by looking at slippage. We want to keep it small, but not really that small, because like if it's kind of like too small, it actually, we need a big fund or like several big funds to push your price to be kind of like to market make. I think that's really hard. Yeah,
absolutely, and it creates some risks for the platform, right? If your liquidity can't sort of match external prices quickly mm-hmm. enough, and right now, I guess that risk is being taken on by the insurance fund. But that sort of changes with Perp V2. Obviously, Perp has grown significantly since launch. You facilitated nearly 20 billion in volume. You've generated like nearly 20 million in fees. You're the largest decentralized perpetuals platform by trading volume, and you're the fourth largest protocol by fees generated overall, which is massive. So, what do you attribute the success of Perp V1 to? And how has this big growth been experienced from your team's perspective?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think there are like several reasons. Of course, I think the first one is that we launched the protocol last December, which is actually a very good timing. Of course, we don't know that, but to be honest, in February, March, actually people trade a lot. Crypto goes up like 2 or 3-fold. So I think that bring lots of trading volume. Traders are looking for venue to trade. So of course they can trade in on central exchange, but they also looking at other alternative venue that they can trade. So definitely one thing, the market is good. The second thing is that we are actually the first protocol that's maybe not the first, but I think it's more at the large scale, deployment on layer 2 or on sidechain. So we pick a Sky. So we are kind of when we launch, we are just like only a few, DeFi protocol launching on the sidechain. So I think that we pay for the gas on the side, on Sky, on sidechain. So people have this experience that they don't really need to think about gas. So they just place a trade, and then Sky is actually 3 times faster than ETH. So the response time is not instant, but it's still much better than on ETH network. So I think that actually helped a lot. People can have their trading strategy. They don't need to think about is it too expensive for me to trade? To open this position. I think that's really great.
Perpetual Protocol has grown significantly since launch. You've facilitated nearly 20 billion in trading volume. You've generated nearly 20 million in fees,
which makes you the largest decentralized perps platform by trading volume, and also the fourth largest protocol overall by fees generated, which is obviously huge. What do you attribute that success to, and how has it been just experiencing that kind of hyper growth?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that, of course, there are a lot of reasons, but I think the first reason is that we actually launched a very good timing. Of course, at the time when we launched, we don't know yet, but the crypto and also DeFi tokens, I mean, like, have a really good run, like in February, March, and April. So, I mean, we launched last December, so we actually, I mean, just like launching a very good time. So, you know, in this like a bull run, lots of traders, they are looking for value to trade. So that's why they come to us. So that's definitely the, like, one of the reasons. The second one is that when we launch, we are actually one of the few that launch on a sidechain or layer two solution. So, I mean, like, if you go to a Perpetual, I mean, website, we launch on XDAI, and you actually don't need to pay, I mean, any gas fee. We pay the gas fee for you. So, I mean, if you want to open a trade, you just like click on, you know, just sign a transaction, and then we will actually send that transaction, I mean, using our system. So, I mean, because you don't really need to think about the fees that you are going to pay, you don't need to think about that, you know, is it worth it to place this order? I think that actually helped a lot from the usability point of view. So that definitely helped. Yeah. And I think the third thing is that, you know, we are an AM. So the AM that we don't really need to kind of have a market maker to really go in and then kind of market make that market. So actually at the time, I mean, when we first launched, we actually kind of like launched like one or two market per week. So that's the speed that we can launch new market. So we can like attract lots of traders, but at the same time, it doesn't really create lots of overhead to the team, or like, you know, we need to go out and find a market maker who are willing to trade that market. So I think that's definitely the reason that, you know, we have this run.
Nick, do you have any thoughts there you want to add, or?
The only other thing I'd say is kind of a little bit more kind of on the product side of things in terms of kind of the product design and the approach that we've taken. So I guess one of the big, like two of the big things that we really believe in is one, kind of accessibility to financial products that normally can't, like retail can't access. And then secondly is kind of how do we simplify or make these products, I guess, a little bit more understandable so that retail users can use them. And you can kind of see that in the product design and I guess even the UI and the user experience that the users have gone through. And a lot of the feedback we get from the community is actually they really like the experience that they get through it. And it's even small things like, because we leverage Byconomy, users don't need to go into to MetaMask, for example, and change their RPC over to XDAI. They can just trade straight through Ethereum, even though the entire protocol is kind of on the XDAI sidechain.
Yeah, absolutely. Can confirm the product's great, really enjoyable experience. And you were kind of a trendsetter with your sidechain move. Obviously, we're seeing the success of Polygon now. So with Perfectly Well, we kind of went into the design a bit and like how to initialize a market, setting K. And I think that sets a nice context for talking about like what were the problems with V1 from your perspective and what was the biggest learning? I guess maybe if you can touch on kind of the long skew issue and how that problem came about, and then we can go on to V2 and how it solves it.
Yeah, I mean the long short skew issue is probably the biggest one that we kind of the unintended consequence, I guess, that we found. Effectively, I guess the reason for that is in order to kind of move the price based on the AMM design, you need people to basically take either a long or short position. So you can imagine when we started ETH and we launched it, the ETH market back in December, I think ETH was about 800. It's like 2K or thereabouts now. So you can imagine there's a lot more longs than there are shorts. And so what happens is in the case where there's like, let's say, funding payments, there's an imbalance of longs and shorts. And so what happens is the insurance fund basically acts as a counterparty, and it either receives or it pays out payments, just depending on kind of the market conditions and kind of the mark price with respect to the index price. And so you can imagine then, if you look at the balance, I guess, of the insurance fund, it doesn't keep going up and goes down maybe due to like a black swan event. It kind of just oscillates. It goes up a little bit, then maybe goes back down, goes back up and goes back down. And that's kind of a risk that we really wanted to address. And we think we've addressed in kind of V2. So I'd say that's the first point. The second point is probably, it's not a problem per se, but it's another thing that we've kind of really focused on with V2, which is around kind of capital efficiency. So the pricing engine that we currently have in V1 is XYK. And if we think of it, I guess, in like an order book setting, it's as though we take equal amounts of liquidity and we kind of place it among the entire order book. Versus, I guess to oversimplify, you look at liquidity on order book, it's normally like a bell curve that's kind of more concentrated around the mark price. So that's the other thing that we were kind of trying to solve for as part of V2.
Awesome. Yeah, Yanwen, do you have anything to add there?
No, I think that's perfect. That's actually the thing that we actually spend a lot of time working with you guys and trying to get it. So yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. It's been a lot of fun. And so obviously in V1, the insurance fund was taking a lot of that risk, right? If effectively having to kind of balance out the market. In V2, mm-hmm. One big difference is that you introduce like liquidity providers, right? And maybe I'll just let you sort of explain V2 from your perspective and how it works for our audience.
So for V2, I think that if you remember that what I said, so like perpetual system, actually we have like two components. So actually the first component remain the same. So we take the USDC as collateral and then we mint virtual token. But we actually swap out the pricing engine. So I mean, the pricing engine used to be an SYK model, and then we swap that out, and then we put in a Uniswap V3. So Uniswap V3, they have this new design that the liquidity provider or maker can decide that which range they want to provide their liquidity with. So it actually opens up lots of design space that the maker actually can do a lot of, I mean, their own strategy. It's not like just a spread, I mean, evenly across that curve. So I think that's actually helped to solve lots of like the problem we mentioned before. So yeah, that's actually like for the V2, that the change that we have. But of course, it's kind of like overview because I think there are lots of detail around this. One of the things that I do want to mention is that because of we have these two components, so actually the liquidity provider or maker, they can provide liquidity with leverage. It kind of like they can provide leverage, you know, 10x, so which means that they can of course earn 10 times more fees, but definitely the risk and they have to think about that. But it definitely creates a lot of leverage for the liquidity provider in this situation.
I'd add kind of two other key pieces that we're kind of planning on doing as part of V2. And the first one is, I guess, just general enhancements to kind of get it to feature parity in terms of centralized exchanges. So we currently run isolated margin only, so allowing cross margin, allowing multi-collateral, so different collateral types. Again, it opens up the design space. And then the second piece, which I think is actually quite interesting that we won't have, obviously, in centralized exchanges is permissionless markets. And so as Yanwen alluded to before, like the way that you kind of put a market in and create a live right now, it goes through a governance vote, and there's kind of some permission in that sense. And the permission is necessary because all of the markets basically share the same insurance fund. So if we just listed any old market and it kind of went to zero, it would kind of drag down the entire protocol in itself. And so we're introducing, I guess, private markets. And the beauty of that is anyone can kind of create a market, whatever they want. And that entire market itself is isolated. The insurance fund is completely isolated. And what that means then is that if that kind of goes down, it doesn't affect the main protocol. So those are the other two pieces, I think, that were the key points to kind of V2.
Yeah, those are super interesting. And I think, so obviously you kind of replaced the price discovery model, right, or the pricing model with rather than XYK, now you have Uni V3. And so that eliminates a lot of the problems with kind of like setting K and the long short skew that results from that, because now you have these LPs that can come in and effectively make markets, right? You have like this maker that you didn't have in V1 that's kind of taking on some of the risks and also some of the rewards of the insurance fund. Yeah. How do you think about sort of, I guess, attracting those liquidity providers? Because you haven't had to do that before, right? You've previously all you needed was kind of like traders, and liquidity providers in V3 are kind of like traders. But yeah, how do you think about that side of things?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we have definitely, I mean, there are several ways. I mean, like trying to attract liquidity providers, definitely we will have like some liquidity mining, I mean, when we launch. So people, I mean, we give out token rewards for people who want to provide liquidity. But in the long run, actually, I believe that if you think about like traditional like market maker, so they, you know, they are like all these central exchange, and then they market make, and then they actually earn lots of money by market making. And we actually have this model open up to like old traders. So they, I mean, like this new like Uni V3 kind of a model actually is kind of like sit between the, you know, limit order book and AM. So it's actually have lots of similarity, I mean, with the limit order book. So I mean, the traditional market maker or like you know, anyone, they can come in and then try, you know, just find your strategy. For example, try to balance your long and short position. I believe, you know, you should be able to earn enough fees, enough yield for your participation. And also, like in our model, we actually just like Uniswap or like SushiSwap, I mean, the liquidity provider actually got most of the fees compared to a central exchange. Central exchange, they give you rebates, maybe like, I don't know, like 5 basis points or something like that, or 25 basis points. But here, I mean, like, you kind of like, you know, you get all the fees. I mean, most of the fees. So, I mean, it actually encourage you to kind of like, you know, build the strategy that works. So I think that, personally, I think there are lots of opportunities in this area. And lots of teams actually are building like on-chain strategy for like everyone. So I believe that there should be like lots of opportunities in the maker side. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. And competition's obviously heating up in the decentralized derivative space. You have several decentralized perps platform either launching or announcing new versions. Like DYDX has an order book model, right, on top of Starkware, and MCDEX, I believe, is launching on top of Arbitrum. How do you think about like the design trade-offs there and kind of where you sit, I guess?
Yeah, that's a good question. So yeah, so let me go with the first. So DYDX, they have like a limit order book. I think that's more like a traditional like centralized exchange way. So they're making like more decentralized. Starkware is pretty cool. Not lots of projects built on Starkware because it's a little bit difficult to build on top of that, but definitely that's an interesting choice. And MCDEX is actually more like AAM, so they design this kind of like a constant and kind of like bell curve style, kind of like a cookie provision that you know, people can provide liquidity using their own algorithm. I think we are actually sit in the middle. I mean, so we are a combination of Uni V3 and virtual tokens. So we actually have some of the characteristics from limit order book and also some of the characteristics from AAM. So, I mean, from order book, you know, people, I mean, like the liquidity provider or maker or market makers, they can pick, I mean, the strategy they want. They can place their, I mean, like kind of like limit order on the curve. So any place they want. So it's actually a lot like limit order book. But at the same time, I mean, the distance is still in AAM. So you need like trades to move the price. And it kind of like, if you look at the liquidity provision, you can kind of, like, you know, get a sense of like the slippage. I mean, it's not like, you know, and also we don't really need a market maker first to kind of like boost the liquidity. We can, I mean, work with like, you know, strategy provider like Charm or Advisor to provide a default strategy. Once, you know, there is a certain amount of like liquidity there, then we can launch our market. So I think that's kind of like a trade-off. It's not, you know, it's not about like good or bad, but you know, different like solution have like different trade-off. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. Jonathan, did you have a question?
or?
Yeah, I was wondering, like, from your perspective, sort of what the main advantage was of adopting sort of this Uniswap V3 style model versus, you know, a centralized limit order book. And from what I understand, it sort of in allowing, you know, retail participants to provide liquidity and to participate as market makers in an easier way. And wanted to sort of know, understand if you agree with that, and yeah, how you see that.
Yeah, I like 100% agree with that, and I think we touched on this point before, but kind of. I think one of the trade-offs, I guess, with a centralized exchange is, in order to get like a good trading experience, you need like an experienced market maker. A, it's quite expensive. B, it takes time. C, you kind of have to then lend them inventory for them to kind of trade against. And so that means that you kind of exclude a lot of assets that can and can't be traded. And Uniswap kind of, yes, they have all the major pairs that do a lot of volume, but like they've got, they've done phenomenally well through kind of the long tail of the assets as well. And so having this AMM model and having, I guess, being able to be composable on Arbitrum means we can kind of build an ecosystem that then allows anyone to kind of build on top of PERP as kind of like a base layer Lego and effectively then launch whatever markets that we want. And it means that like we don't, for those that are less technically inclined, we're still being inclusive of them because maybe we have like a default on-chain strategy that they can use, or one of the partners has a default on-chain strategy that they can use. And so everyone can still kind of participate in this ecosystem, and it's not limited to a small set of users.
That's very interesting. Nick, could you get a bit more into sort of the, like how this model allows PERP to sort of to scale into the long tail of asset markets? And on the other hand, could you dive a bit deeper into sort of how you see composability playing within the decentralized perpetuals market, and how a model like Uniswap V3 sort of helps PERP V2 sort of be composable within the ecosystem?
Sure. So I guess with the long tail of assets, it's kind of what we touched upon before, which is around kind of private markets. So the plan right now, I guess, is staked PERP, or users who stake PERP receive staked PERP, and then they can stake that into the private markets to effectively act as a backstop, and obviously receive a percentage of the fees there. So they increase their risk slightly, but they receive a portion of the fees there as well. What that does then is once there's enough kind of staked PERP in that market can launch. It's a private market. All it needs is a price feed. And you can then kind of launch whatever market you want. I guess the beauty of this is, again, we can then start capturing assets and launching kind of perpetual assets a lot sooner than, I guess, kind of other players, where traditionally you might need a little bit of track record, protocol's got to be live for a little bit, then you kind of have to raise funds, you got to then find a market maker and so forth. So the time to actually get a product live, the time actually reduces quite significantly. So that's probably the first part of your question. The second part around kind of composability and the ability to kind of build composability, I think there's a couple of benefits with UniV3 as well, in that there's a lot of research that's kind of been going on into the space as well. And so we've seen at least the ability for other partners to kind of port over, let's say, if they're building out a market making strategy for UniV3, for example, it's not too short of a hop to kind of then port that over to PERP and build on top of it. I think it also, the composability piece means that the design space actually opens up significantly. So before, where you might need like a fund might has to have a lot of infrastructure connected to a lot of kind of disparate systems. Now it's a lot easier for kind of engineers to kind of plug and play. Like I want to pull in Compound, and I might pull in, I don't know, like a fixed interest market. Plus I might pull in PERPs and then kind of create some crazy strategy out of that. Like there's so many kind of possibilities that we haven't probably even thought of that are now available kind of with this composability.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot of, you know, sort of creativity to be discovered, you know, within the decentralized perpetuals market that we haven't seen yet, and that the launch of you know, protocols of like Perp V2 are going to allow. So yeah, really exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And definitely agree with you on the trade-offs of AMMs versus central limit order books, where I think AMMs are going to be able to tap into a lot more retail capital, right? Because there's sort of an easy way, like with that kind of that strategist middleware layer, there's an easy way for retail to just onboard liquidity onto these strategies in a way that there isn't with a central limit order book, right? Where it's much more difficult to have those on-chain strategies. And so you end up having to have both the market makers and the capital providers be the same person. Whereas with Uni V3, you can kind of separate that out, right? You can have a market maker like Charm or Visor, and then you can have a capital provider separately. So I think you end up tapping into more capital, which is super cool. And then in terms of scaling Perp, you were obviously super early to this. You know, you bet on Matic kind of and on sidechain design before anyone else did. And now obviously that's seen a lot of traction. How are you thinking about scaling Perp like long term? Are you thinking about other chains? Are you thinking about any layer twos? Yeah, what are your plans there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we've been on SKY for some time, and I think because the new design of Perp V2, we actually need to use, I mean, Uniswap V3. So we have to be on a chain or a sidechain or a layer two that has Uniswap V3. So I think that the decision that we have right now is probably go to Arbitrum first, because like Uniswap announced that they are going to deploy on Arbitrum, and then they actually deploy it. So I think that's probably the first one. But I think we will definitely look at other layer two or like sidechains that Uniswap are going to deploy on, so that you know, we can utilize that.
All right, so we've seen significant growth and adoption for decentralized spot trading protocols. Obviously, that started off with Uniswap and has kind of grown since. But we haven't seen the same thing materialize in the same way for decentralized derivatives. In the traditional world, in the traditional centralized world, derivatives volumes are a multiple of spot volumes, whereas in the decentralized world, they're still like a fraction. So why do you think that is? And when do you think that there's something sort of intrinsic about the decentralized that makes derivatives less attractive, or is it just a question of these products improving to catch up to their centralized counterparts?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, of course, like we only have like 6 months of experience. I mean, like it's not like 100% for sure, but personally, I think it's just like, you know, our product is not there yet. So, I mean, like lots of our users, they come in and they compare us to like central exchange like FKX, which is kind of like really good, I mean, central exchange. And, you know, they compare the features, they compare the speed. I mean, like, even if we are on SDAI, every time you want to place a trade, you have to sign. And then after signing, you have to wait like 5 seconds compared to like, FKX is like within that second. So I think it's, you know, we still have a long way to go. That's actually the reason that we put in lots of features that trying to be on par with FKX. So we want to have close margin, we want to have like non-USDC collateral, trying to bring more features from like this central exchange. So to go back to your question, I personally believe that it's just like, I mean, the product is not mature enough. And I think we are just like, you know, we will be there, we will get there. I mean, we are just trying to work hard and then trying to get there. Yeah.
I mean, I think as an ecosystem as a whole, we're still kind of a little bit immature in kind of the user experience side of things. Like, I think all of us here are super crypto native, but if you take kind of non-crypto native people and you try to explain it to them, you're basically telling them to kind of trust all their money in kind of this Chrome extension effectively. And so there's kind of usually people kind of do a double take. And so I think as we kind of educate users more on kind of the benefits of DeFi and I guess Ethereum and kind of decentralized finance in general, and as we kind of build out our products and as an ecosystem to kind of get to that better user experience, I think that kind of liquidity and that kind of trading volume will happen that we see in centralized exchanges.
That's awesome. And I guess to finish up, just like a really big question, but it's obviously hard to predict things in crypto. I don't think anyone could have predicted where we are now a year ago, maybe even 6 months ago. But how do you see the decentralized derivatives market looking like 5-10 years from now? Like, do you think there's going to be crypto native products? Obviously, Paradigm released their sort of perpetual options product recently that we're seeing some projects build around. Like, yeah, how are you seeing it? What are you personally excited about? And where do you think it's going?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, personally, I agree with you that there will be like crypto native, derivative product, in like 5 years. Yeah, just like perpetual swap. So perpetual swap itself is of course it's a swap. I mean, of course the same concept probably like happened in like sometime in the traditional financial market, but itself is actually a crypto native product. So that's the first one. And then the perpetual option you mentioned, Paradigm really did a good job like trying to. I mean, nobody talked about this in a traditional finance world. I think there are lots of difference from crypto, like financial, like DeFi to traditional finance. I think one of the differences is that it's actually driven by engineers, and then it's 24/7. So people just trying to. I mean, for engineers, they want to we want to have like something that you can put out there and then it runs. Just like blockchain, right? So, no central party like taking care of that. So I think it's actually have a lot of different thinking than traditional finance. So definitely there will be like a more product like this, like perpetual swap, like perpetual option, perpetual interest rate swap. I don't know, but definitely I believe like there will be like something new in this, blockchain world. And then that also will be the most popular one in the future. Yeah.
I'd echo that. I think we're in the very early innings of kind of composability and what it can do and what we can do with it, I guess. And because most products are still so early, it's kind of a lot of the focus is still around kind of building the products themselves rather than kind of how can we plug these Lego blocks together and how do we kind of build new and different things that we kind of never have thought about. So I'm super excited to kind of see what this happens and kind of what innovations come out of it.
Yeah, no, it's super exciting for us as well. We really appreciate you coming on the podcast, talking through V2. It's been a real pleasure kind of working with you over the last few months and seeing the advancements in your thinking and thinking about these private markets. I think people are going to be really excited about V2. I think it's a meaningfully better experience than V1 and kind of does really push this, the cross collateral and stuff does really start pushing this to sort of a SEX level or a centralized exchange level experience. So I guess before we go, just where can people catch up with you? And if people are interested in learning more about PERP, where should they go?
They can go to our website. So it's perp.fi, PERP.fi. And so there are like all your Discord link is there. So I think most of the developer and community can hang out in Discord. So welcome to join us.
Awesome. Thanks very much, Yanwen, Nick, and John for co-hosting. Looking forward to having you on again and looking forward to PERP V2.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for inviting us. Yeah, have a good one.
Before we go, we want to again thank our sponsor for this episode, Kava. With a proven track record of delivering products safely, the Kava platform is DeFi's most trusted, scalable, and secure institutional-grade cross-chain engine. In addition to the protocols Kava and Hard, Kava Labs will soon be launching its Swap protocol, a cross-chain AMM liquidity hub bridging DeFi, blockchains, and financial services to swap the world's largest assets and maximize yields across your entire portfolio. Try for yourself or learn more by visiting kava.io today. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.